Lynn Povich is an award-winning journalist who's worked as editor-in-chief of Working Woman, managing editor for MSNBC.com, and she was the first female senior editor at Newsweek. Ms. Povich has written a book that describes her early years at Newsweek in the 1960s and focuses on the lawsuit for job equality instituted by the women who worked there in 1970. She's called her book The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. It's published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased it has brought Lynn Povich to our show today. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you so much.
So what was it like for a woman to work at Newsweek when you were hired in 1965? What kinds of jobs were available?
Well, the news magazines work differently than newspapers, where reporters go out, write stories, come back, report stories, come back and write them. At the news magazines, Henry Luce created a structure where every function was segregated. So the reporters reported stories, the writers wrote them, and the fact-checkers or researchers fact-checked them. What happened in these places was that only men were hired as reporters, writers, and editors, and only women were hired as researchers.
And that was true at Time magazine as well?
That was true at Time. Newsweek just copied the Time system. And so all of us came in. Actually, women started on the mail desk, and then they moved up to clipping newspapers and into research. And the situation was that you couldn't get promoted out of research, even if you had written for other newspapers or had written for your college newspaper.
And there was a long tradition of women working as journalists by this time.
Women at newspapers were writing and reporting often in what was then called the women's pages, but magazines like Business Week hired women out of college to become writers.
And TV journalists like Marlene Sanders were reporting from Vietnam.
Yes. And a woman wanted to cover Vietnam at Newsweek and was told she couldn't because she was a woman.
Well, the owner of Newsweek was a woman, Katharine Graham. Was she aware of the situation?
When we announced our suit, the Monday, March 16th, 1970, the editor called her. She was on vacation to tell her that the women had sued Newsweek. And she famously said, "Which side am I supposed to be on?"
So nobody had talked to her about it before, I imagine.
No, there had been discussion among the women about maybe we should just go and approach Katharine Graham. You know, she would understand. But we just felt that as the lowest of the low on the masthead, we didn't have any leverage.
But wasn't Title VII already in effect when you joined Newsweek?
Yes, the Civil Rights Act, interestingly enough, was in effect. And when the first person who started our suit was a young researcher named Judy Gingold, who was a Marshall Scholar and could not find a job when she came back from England. And when she was having lunch with a friend of hers who was a lawyer and explaining the system at Newsweek, the woman said to her, "Do you know that's illegal?" And Judy had no idea. And she said, "Well, call the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission," which Judy did. The woman said, "Yes, that's illegal." And Judy said, "Well, I don't think the men know it's illegal."
But then it took you 6 years to, after a passage of Title VII, to actually sue Newsweek.
Yes, and I think...
Was this something that took a long time to get everybody on board?
Well, I think you called
them the good girls. Obviously, people didn't want to cause trouble.
Well, there were women who came to Newsweek who wanted to be writers and saw right away they were never going to be writers and left for very successful careers, people like Nora Ephron and Jane Bryan Quinn and Ellen Goodman and Susan Brown Miller. The rest of us good girls were happy to have a job in a really interesting place. And I think I started covering the women's movement in 1968-69. I think when we started realizing there was a women's movement and that it didn't just apply to those women, but actually, guess what, guys? It applies to us. We woke up. There was that moment. I call it the Rosa Parks moment. What made Rosa Parks decide one day she wasn't moving to the back of the bus?
So there were 46 women involved. Was that the majority of women working at Newsweek?
It was all of the researchers and women in the letters department. The only people we couldn't get to join us were the black women researchers.
Do you know why?
Yes. They felt, first of all, their priority was to the civil rights movement. They felt more discriminated against as blacks at that point in time. And they also felt that we very highly educated, middle-class white women's concerns about getting ahead at work didn't cover the context of their lives. They had to work. They had no choice. They were concerned about families and men, and they wanted to wait and see that if the blacks were going to organize, they would do that.
Well, you chose Eleanor Holmes Norton, who is now the congresswoman from D.C. as your lawyer in 1970. Was that just coincidental, or was that with an eye toward the black employees who didn't want to join it?
No, I think the women at Newsweek, the black women, had decided not to join us before Eleanor signed on. We went to Eleanor because none of the women in law firms were doing civil rights law and didn't know how to do it. And so we realized, and some wanted money, which we didn't have. So we realized, actually, this is about civil rights. We should go to the ACLU. And Eleanor was there and was wonderful. She's one of the few black women who at the time also was very much part of the women's movement and felt black women should be part of the women's movement.
My guest is Lynn Povich. Her book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace. You begin your book by talking about some of the women who have worked at Newsweek more recently, like Jessica Bennett, Jesse Ellison, Sarah Bell, Ball. Were you surprised when they contacted you?
I was flabbergasted. I didn't know their frustrations at Newsweek. And, of course, there's no researchers at Newsweek, so the women are now all hired as reporters or writers. And I was appalled by the fact that there wasn't a stitch of evidence about our case at Newsweek that no one knew except a guy in the library.
Well, Eleanor Clift was one of the women at the magazine at the time. She's still at Newsweek. Did you not talk about this with the other people?
She works in Washington. These young women work in New York. And I guess the subject just didn't come up.
So they had received permission to write about the lawsuit and about current workplace discrimination as a cover story in 2010. And they were finding certain similarities?
Yes. They contacted us because they were frustrated. These girls were really smart, super competent, and yet once they were in the work world, they were feeling that somehow they weren't getting ahead, that younger guys with same or less experience were getting better stories and they were marginalized. And because it was post-feminism that, you know, we're all equal now, they didn't identify it as discrimination.
I'm assuming that things have changed at the magazine since, because Tina Brown, who's the current editor of Newsweek, praised your book earlier today on NPR's Morning Edition.
Yes. I mean, Tina, obviously, first of all, she is the first woman editor of Newsweek, which is thrilling to have a woman at the top of
magazine. An editor, but not the top editor.
The editor. I was a senior editor. She is the editor or editor-in-chief. I'm not quite sure how she calls herself. So that's thrilling, and we were all so happy that she got that job. But yes, it's a different structure now. She has a lot of women executives.
Now, the ironic part of this is that your group announced the lawsuit in 1970 to coincide with a cover story at Newsweek about feminism. The story was being written by a woman, but not a woman on staff?
Yes. When the editors decided that the women's movement was actually a newsworthy development and that they needed to do a cover story on it, they had no women experienced enough to write the cover. I was actually a junior writer, but really not a cover writer at that point. And so they knew they couldn't have a man write it, and they had no women there. And so they went outside and hired Helen Dudar, a star writer at the New York Post, to come and write the story.
But your suit came out, and people at the Post and elsewhere were stunned to learn that this was going on at Newsweek.
Well, we timed our suit to be announced the day that Newsweek appeared on the stands with a cover story saying Women in Revolt, because we knew the publicity would really humiliate the editors more than the discrimination.
And what was their reaction? Did they call you in and say, what's going on?
Yes. I mean, first of all, Oz Elliott, the editor at the time, released a statement which only underscored the institutional sexism of the place. He said the fact that all men are writers and virtually all the women are researchers is a news magazine tradition that goes back 50 years. What more can one say? And immediately called for a meeting with the women. And we had one the next day with Eleanor Holmes Norton as our lawyer, and she said, don't speak until I get there. And in walks a 5'7" African-American, 7-month pregnant woman with an afro. And they were just stunned by her. And, you know, Eleanor is very fiery, very persuasive. And just sort of mopped up the floor.
Well, but you still had to go to court.
They actually settled. It never went to court. They settled very quickly and promised to hire and promote. Unfortunately, the language was pretty vague, and it allowed them in the next 2 years really not to progress very much.
So that's why you filed the second lawsuit in 73. The problem was they said, well, women hadn't had experience as writers, reporters, so we have to train them to do this?
Yes. I mean, the first three women who tried out, I mean, one of the women, Pat Linden, had published in the New York Times Magazine and the Atlantic cover stories. Mary Plachette had published in Village Voice. They were publishing elsewhere, but they all failed at Newsweek.
Well, you became, after this, things did change. There was a real attempt to improve conditions for women?
Yes. I think our second lawyer, Harriet Rabb, got a commitment to goals and timetables of having one-third of the writers and the reporters be women by the end of 1974 and a woman senior editor by the end of 75. So they were held to be accountable.
And you were the first woman to be named senior editor at Newsweek. Were other women given real jobs of responsibility?
Yes. I mean, I would say between 75 and 85, there was enormous progress. Another fellow researcher of mine, Meryl McLaughlin, became the first woman business editor, the first national affairs editor, and women became foreign correspondents.
But you also suggest, as we discussed a little earlier, that it wasn't a complete revolution, that women as recently as 2 years ago were still feeling that they weren't being given the same opportunities.
Well, as I say, like the civil rights movement, the women's movement hasn't solved everything. There are still many issues for women at work.
Isn't there also that matter of people claiming that there's an ambition gap between men and women?
Yeah, Sheryl Sandberg at Facebook calls it an ambition gap. And I feel that, you know, the young women I meet are very ambitious. I think it's more of a confidence gap, and I've talked about that with Jessica Bennett. Young women, I mean, surprising for us because we were raising daughters we hoped would feel that they could do anything and be anything, and they are incredibly smart and super competent. But there is an issue about confidence. I have a friend who runs a news organization and says that in the last 20 years as a boss, only two women have ever come in and asked for a raise.
On the other hand, when a woman does come across as ambitious, she's usually called pushy. If a man is ambitious, he's usually called a go-getter.
Absolutely. The women, ambition in women is still stigmatized.
So where are you now? Your father, by the way, worked for the Washington Post. He was a famous journalist. In fact, you've been working on his famous sports reports. That's the same parent company. Was he concerned that you were causing trouble?
No, you know, I was in the odd position of suing my father's boss and good friend, Catherine Graham. But once I explained the injustice to him, he understood.
Are you still at MSNBC.com?
No, I left a while ago. And.
Have you found that the broadcast media have been more enlightened than the print media when it comes to giving women high-level jobs?
Well, you know, what the broadcast media did was to put women in front of the camera and African Americans in front of the camera very early in the 70s. That was part of their licensing.
After some lawsuits.
Yes, and their licensing agreements had to, provide for diversity. You still don't see women running the show in television news.
Well, you don't see women running the show in practically anything. Of the Fortune 500 corporations, only 12 or 13 have women as their presidents.
That's correct. And that is, you know, we thought it was a pipeline issue that once you had the women, and they are in middle and senior management, but they're having a hard time getting into the top.
Lynn Povich's book, The Good Girls Revolt, How the Women of Newsweek Sued Their Bosses and Changed the Workplace, is published by Public Affairs. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Leonard.